You know how parts of the United States have state-run retail locations for booze? People call them ABC stores, and they hold partial or full monopolies over the pricing, sale, and profit on beverage alcohol. And other states don't, and some countries do, but other countries don't. What's up with that? Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Fingers Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Infante, also known as Dinfante, also known as DJ Disappoint Your Parents, and I'm coming at you from Fingers HQ here in suburban New Jersey. Today, exclusively for paying friends of Fingers, I've got part two of two from my interview with James Wilt, author of Drinking Up the Revolution, How to Smash Big Alcohol and Reclaim Working Class Joy. It's a new book that reveals how global booze conglomerates have managed to mostly insulate themselves from the severe government regulation and public health scrutiny that finally brought down Big Tobacco, despite doing all sorts of public health harm just like Big Tobacco did. I highly, highly recommend you pick up the book. You can get it at the Fingers Reading Room or probably at your local library, hopefully. The reason I am so into it is because it shifted so many paradigms for me with regards to how I think about the global alcohol business. Even if you're some sort of diehard free market, anti-Marxist, conservative type, I think you will find Drinking Up the Revolution really thought-provoking, at least, and challenging. Also, what are you doing listening to the Fingers Podcast with those politics? Drop me a line. I would genuinely love to know how you got here because we don't get many of your kind around these parts, but we're glad to have you. Anyway, my interview with James took place a little earlier this fall and lasted nearly 2 hours, which is why I broke it up into two separate parts. Over the course of the conversation, we talked about everything from the ways in which global booze capital flexes its political muscles to how craft beverage producers inadvertently give cover to their corporate counterparts to his vision for a fairer, safer system for distributing drink without the profit motive dictating the terms of engagement. I found it fascinating the whole way through, and I hope you do too. Make sure to go back and check out part one if you haven't yet, and you can definitely listen to them out of order. It doesn't really matter. It's just him and I talking about the book and its themes. Before I roll the interview, I just wanted to say one more quick thank you for supporting Fingers with your hard-earned money. The Booze Letter generally and subscriber-only podcast episodes like this in particular cannot exist without friends of Fingers stepping up to underwrite my independent coverage about drinking in America. I'm so grateful that you are one of them. Without further ado, here's part two of the Fingers Podcast with James Wilt. Another angle of this book that I thought was, I've used the word challenging and the words challenging and compelling a few times, and I keep on coming back to those provocative because it's not that I haven't, I've been covering this business for over a decade. It's not that I haven't thought through these angles, but I don't think I've ever really seen them presented as convincingly. Like, you make very persuasive arguments around one of the things that I want to talk about now is supply versus demand, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
A pat argument, and one that you'd hear, I think, if you brought the majority of my listeners into the room with us right now, you'd hear from them is, well, the reason that people are drinking is because they like to drink. Like, we like alcohol. We enjoy it. You yourself say you enjoy it. That's a demand side, observation, for sure. Right? You make the case that sure, there is demand, and that's true. But what we fail to acknowledge is that the supply side is not just serving the demand, but looking for ways to generate additional demand and make sure that demand never recedes and only accrues.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of that happens through marketing and retail positioning and retail ubiquity. So some of the things I want to talk about now are, when we talk about competition, we talk about lowering price, right? That's that's the market is going to deliver the best goods for the best price. The market will decide. In the case of alcohol and price,
Yeah.
which bears out at retail.
For sure.
There's a lot of research that suggests alcohol is not properly priced for the harms for sure. it creates in society.
Yeah.
James, like, no one wants to hear that their beer is going to get more expensive.
Yeah.
But the case that I think that you make, and again, you make it persuasively. I'm not saying you're wrong, but
for sure.
Tell me a little bit about how you see your politics, your vision for what this market could be, or this industry could be playing out at retail, playing out for the consumer.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, it's a great question. Where to begin? I think part of this is unpacking or just like thinking slightly more critically about the sheer ubiquity of alcohol. Like the fact that it is procurable basically like anywhere, like, you know, to think of like even online delivery or to, you know, takeouts from restaurants and bars. All of these things are, for the most part, are very, very new. But the way that they've sort of become normalized and situated within society is just like sort of another way to access this good that everyone wants, I think is like troublesome, but it also speaks to like sort of the craftiness of the industry itself. And so, so in terms of like what my vision of retail would look like is that I do think that, and this kind of speaks to the broader politics of the book, which might be controversial. I mean, all this is controversial, but I think at the end of the day, it really has to come down to owning, controlling, retailing alcohol as a public good, as opposed to something that is like something that is primarily motivated by private profit. And so in regards to retail, like we see this in Canada, we see this in the US, in Scandinavia, in India, there's, you know, a lot of places where this plays out is that the state owns retailers. And,
sure.
and this is a super, you know, in, you know, state of Washington, this was recently rescinded like a couple of years ago. And now you can buy it everywhere. So it's not like this isn't like a very live political issue. But I think that the fact that these continue to function, I think, in a very effective way. And the public health research that kind of supports this is that state-owned or public-owned retailers, you can more directly control the pricing and the density and the hours, which is a really big public health, like a lot of research behind like why this is important. You can control you can stabilize the pricing, especially in rural and remote areas, which is important for like equity and access to alcohol. You can provide good unionized work, which should be a priority for like everyone on the left or progressive circles. Mm-hmm. And just in general, like by eliminating or by moderating the profit motive, you can try to reduce the amount that alcohol is pushed as an end to profit. And so I think all of those are represent like a real world not alternative, but like an option that should be studied and considered in comparison to just this ever increasing commodification of alcohol in the retail space. I think really it's just about recognizing that the way that alcohol continues to roll out, especially in the retail space, which is like people's most like intimate and direct relationship with the industry itself, unless you work in it, means that you're just going to be continually surrounded by cheaper and cheaper and more like interesting and, you know, like enticing alcohol without, like you say, you know, the actual cost to health and society being factored into that at any point.
Sure.
The one last thing I'll just throw in for consideration is in terms of like the demand side piece, like no capitalist industry can operate without demand. There has to be some sort of latent demand. Like if you produce a product that isn't wanted, it's not a, you know, it's not a commodity. It won't be, you know, purchased or consumed. And there's been a lot of, you know, products that have been attempted that haven't worked out, and that's just part of the deal. But I think another part of the supply side piece is thinking through the innovations and products. And most recently with the hard seltzer, you know, craze, and you know, we can discuss whether that's long lasting or what that means. But I think what's really interesting about, you know, the White Claws of the world or the Trulies or whatever is that a lot of them have really honed in on people's real legitimate concerns about some of the health impacts. And you'll notice that, you know, nutritional information isn't mandated on most alcoholic beverages, but it is disclosed very willingly by hard seltzer companies, you know, having, you know, low sugar, low carbs, you know, all these sorts of things.
99 calories. It's always got to be under 100 calories. It got the slim can, certainly no carbs, gluten-free. These are all responses to consumer demand that were forcing beer out of its comfort zone in a way that the liquid could not accommodate. So you don't lose that customer. You just create a different product that answers those customers' questions.
Yeah, exactly. Like you basically anticipate and integrate concerns into new products, and then you just ratchet that up. And like just the way that it becomes like even the product and the experience itself can become ubiquitous in new ways. Like this is how the industry morphs and how it shapes. It's not like this kind of thing where it just, you know, creates a beverage and then it automatically gets taken up. There's a lot of reflexivity and a lot of interaction between consumers, like between the drinkers and the products themselves. Like, you know, even like the meme stuff around White Claw or whatever. Like it's a very reflexive thing, which does not challenge the political economy of big alcohol. Like it is very adept at just being able to pivot, to be able to morph, to be able to integrate all these things. And so, just wanted to shout that out as one sort of supply piece.
Absolutely. Let's talk about supply and demand in the context of something near and dear to my heart, which is the malt liquor industry, segment of the marketplace here in the US in the late 80s, early 90s. And I was very flattered when I was reading Drinking Up the Revolution. I came across your coverage of malt liquor, and I flipped back to the bibliography and I saw that you actually cited one of my stories about the malt liquor business. And I was very flattered. And I think it was the way you framed it was right on. And I want to talk a little bit about supply versus demand in that context. Mm-hmm. First of all, because I understand what was going on at that time, because I've reported about it before. But second of all, because I think we can learn lessons from how malt liquor went down in the 80s and 90s and apply them to what's going on contemporarily today. So you mentioned equity just a moment ago, and there's a quote from your book that I want to open with, if you don't mind here. Open this portion of the pod with. You write, quote, "To be poor and racialized is to be constantly conflated, stigmatized, infantilized, and degraded as in an almost permanent state of intoxication, and ultimately eugenicist race science that simultaneously celebrates the extensive substance abuse used by rich white people in ritzy condos, suburbs, and sports bars." So there's a lot going on in that sentence. I underlined it when I read it, and I think it really provides a rich backdrop to discuss what happened in the U.S. with regards to malt liquor. For any listeners who aren't aware, I'll give you the quick and dirty. Malt liquor was rolled out as a product innovation in the post-war years. So after World War II, a lot of American GIs come back from Europe with a new taste for wine and spirits. And for the first time, basically since the post-prohibition era, where the big brewers, you know, come back online and have a lot more share because spirits had been, you know, had taken a much bigger hit. For the first time, America's brewers have to figure out an answer to what would become their, you know, century-long foe in wine and spirits, particularly spirits. What they came up with was malt liquor, a higher ABV product that they initially were marketing to wealthy, you know, like middle class white people in like Levittown suburbs. They encourage, you know, people to pour it over ice, serve it in coupe glasses. It was supposed to be this higher end product. Never really got uptake in that segment of the market. You know, that demographic didn't really ever, you know, take to malt liquor, but it hung around, and all of a sudden, you know, in the 70s and 80s, there, you know, obviously this is compounded by white flight and a ton of redlining and other racist policies to gut America's cities, basically, in favor of the suburbs. But in concentrated urban areas that were overwhelmingly demographically black and non-white, I guess, not just black, but certainly black was a major population. You start seeing a ton of volume of malt liquor. There's a lot of bang for your buck in the product, and it was finding a lot of resonance with with the lower income community, which in this country, of course, is overwhelmingly not white because of this country's history of racism. Yeah. From there, you get marketing, you get a feedback loop where they're marketing more towards those audiences, so those audiences are buying more of it, and yada yada yada. You get spokespeople like Billy Dee Williams and every single rapper you've ever heard of, all the legends. You got Biggie, you got Snoop Dogg, you got Ice Cube. All of them are doing what we would think about as now as like sponsored content. You know, they were cutting music videos for like St. Ives and Colt 45. And, you know, the party was over by the mid-90s because It had turned into a full-blown public health crisis where every single liquor store in, you know, what we came to know as the hood, right? Boys in the Hood being like the the reference text for that that framing. But every single liquor store had, you know, the 40s of malt liquor. That became a visual shorthand for being, you know, in a black neighborhood or being in a rap video, right? And there's a ton of really, really good scholarship done on this by someone else you cited, who has also been a source of mine over the years, Dr. J. Nicole Jackson Beckham, who has written a lot about this before. But malt liquor strikes me, you know, so anyway, the Surgeon General cracked down hard on a couple malt liquor companies and it kind of petered out. It's still around certainly, but it's nowhere near the boom that it once was. And the alcohol companies moved on to other more lucrative, products. The reason I bring that up and I want to talk about that a little bit more is there's a benign version of that story that's really framed around, well, it found a market. People liked it. People were drinking it. Like there's nothing inherently sinister about that. That is not the story that I wound up finding when I reported. And it's not the one that you found when you were writing the book about it. Can you tease out the tension there between that narrative of demand side? Well, they wanted it, and supply side, well, like you're pumping it into the community.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, for starters, your reporting on malt liquor is like excellent. I mean, there's a good reason I cited it. It's like, it's really, really well done. So this particular section of the book takes place within a chapter where I'm really looking at the racialization of the quote unquote problem drinker. You know, I'm gonna just kind of like insert air quotes throughout this bit. So the first one is the first section of the chapter looks at FASD or fetal alcohol syndrome in Canada, and specifically the way it's been pathologized as a specifically like indigenous disease, First Nations, Métis, Inuit, and the way that is like very racialized at its core, and the way that it's like this very reflexive thing in which the issues that are perceived by public health practitioners in indigenous communities is there's kind of this confirmation bias that can happen where it's just like read as FASD, even though FASD is like notoriously hard to diagnose, especially in adults. So that's the first part of that. The second one looks at sort of the geography and like the white supremacist underpinnings of alcohol, and like specifically liquor store concentration in black neighborhoods, which is where this sort of plays out. And so there's like a through line in which, and as you've already mentioned, is that like, so black drinkers and Latino drinkers specifically were pathologized in this way as just having this like innate desire for malt liquor. Like it's just
more potent liquor. And like, exactly. That was inherent in the marketing, right? Colt 45, Crazy Horse, like St. Ides, which was Ice Cube explicitly linked with virility and sexual prowess, right? Like which gets back to some of those very, very nasty tropes about black men in chattel slavery that are like they're sexually potent, they're coming after white women, et cetera, et cetera. Those what you're describing is like that was all baked in there.
And it, like you say, that like the way that it was marketed and the way that the retail was like specifically contained in black neighborhoods, like where it wasn't like really mixed with other like options or that sort of thing, was like very, very pronounced. But you know, a lot of the scholarship that's come out in recent years, and this also I guess involves craft beer in a lot of ways, is that sort of liquor landscapes in the US and Canada are deeply racialized and connected to the way that like land use planning has played out in terms of what you mentioned about the white flight, but also the concentration of racialization and poverty within certain neighborhoods. So, you know, when Korean or Asian store owners open up like a liquor store, which is one of like sort of the few things available to do for a whole bunch of different reasons, is that that has to be like, that can only happen within certain neighborhoods because of like white supremacy and sure. because of racism and all these sorts of things. And so the way that it becomes like oversaturated is the result of like ultimately racism and you know, racist land use planning.
Just to tease that out real quick, yeah, James, sorry. Yeah, yeah. It's like when you say white supremacy and racism, and that's the result, or that's what results in this higher concentration of liquor stores. I'm pretty sure I understand what you're saying. I just want to make sure, because you know, people understandably get a little frustrated when people just like lump everything under white supremacy, like, oh, we can only blame white supremacy. It's this big umbrella, sure. right? But what you mean are very specific things. You can get into this in the book. We're talking about zoning. We're talking about capital flight out of these communities. That creates a vacuum where now we have like empty retail stores. So now you have immigrants that are able to come in, you know, Koreans in the case of Los mm-hmm. Angeles, you know, famously run a lot of the grocery stores, run a lot of liquor stores. They also don't necessarily have access to educational opportunities. So they are then looking at liquor stores as their path to the middle class, because it requires a very limited amount of education, formal education, I mean, mm-hmm. to be able to have a success in the liquor store. So James is shorthanding because he's done all this work. I just want to make it clear to listeners that it's not just him trying to like kind of give himself cover by like throwing buzzwords out there.
No. It's totally true. Yeah. This is to do with like zoning laws and organized abandonment and like the way that marketing is like very specifically targeted. And just to speak of some of the recent studies that have looked at this, is that there was a review of 10,000 zip codes across the US, and this is just a quote, is that they argued that mismatches between alcohol demand and the supply of liquor stores within urban neighborhoods constitute an environmental injustice for minorities and lower income persons. And then there's another study that looked specifically at Baltimore in terms of like the over concentration of that. But in each of these cases, the argument I think has been made very convincingly that this is the result not of like just like insatiable demand driving this, but it's the fact that supply has been really targeted and restricted to certain areas, and in turn that's like shaped the marketing and all these sorts of things.
Just to use a contemporary example from outside of the beverage alcohol business, it kind of reminds me of a month or so ago, Instagram really jacked up its algorithm and started prioritizing videos even more than they already had been. It caused a pretty big amount of backlash amongst some of its power users, including a couple of the Kardashians, who are, you know, some of the biggest users on the platform, and they complained about it. So one of their executives got up there and was like, well, listen, like, we're just prioritizing video because you guys are engaging more with video. To which a lot of critics correctly, I think, responded, the only reason we're engaging more with these video motherfuckers is because you keep forcing them down our throats. So it's like, it's this question of like, well, we're just doing it because the demand's there. And it's like, with the demand's only there because the supply is overwhelming us. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And this, it's not to like eliminate the agency of drinkers in these situations. Like, of course, there's still like, you know, fully willing, participation in these systems. But I think what this chapter tries to call attention to is like the systems are like rooted in these, like in these structures of racism and all these other things. The one other thing about malt liquor, which you'll know, is that like these are all owned by like the, you know, the big alcohol, you know, companies.
There's not a lot of craft malt liquor produced.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Although I think some craft brewers have tried.
But like, only as like kind of a gross like white guy, it's like a joke thing.
Which like, and yeah, final point on that is like the reason I kind of alluded to craft beer earlier was that there's been a lot of studies of the whiteness of craft breweries as an industry, but also like the geographies of craft beer and like the relationship. And I mean, there's a lot of, you know, contestation about whether craft beer leads or follows gentrification, but there's no doubt at all that it plays some role in gentrification.
Yeah. To me, that's sort of a distinction without a difference, right? Like, did it get here first, or did it become the capstone of this gentrified community? Well, like ultimately once the community is gentrified, that matters less than the fact that it has been gentrified.
And like, and craft beer from, you know, production all the way down to consumption is overwhelmingly white and male. Like it's like, it's like kind of unequivocal, especially if you look at like ownership like the head brewer positions, all that sort of thing. So I think that's like sort of an important, not counterweight, but like consideration to think alongside sort of the way that alcohol has been racialized in these ways. And the last section of that chapter looks at like sort of policing and incarceration and the way that that's like targeted public drinking and intoxication in like highly racialized ways, which I'm sure like anyone
who
lives in any, yeah, yeah. Anyone no, who lives in any like US or Canadian right. city. Yeah, yeah, that's right. but yeah, so it's kind of like, it's part of this bigger package, which hopefully makes some sort of coherent sense.
Yeah, no, it very much does. I want to bring it home here. Again, we're talking about Drinking Up the Revolution by James Will. Subtitle is How to Smash Big Alcohol and Reclaim Working Class Joy. I want to turn our attention for this last section of the podcast towards that subtitle, How to Smash Big Alcohol, mm-hmm. and specifically in the second half, and Reclaim Working Class Joy, right? Like you've made, I think, pretty persuasive arguments throughout this podcast and certainly throughout the book that big alcohol generates a lot of negative externalities, sure. you know, on behalf of profit seeking of global capital. But you've also been very cautious or very careful to acknowledge that people have legitimate like use value or put legitimate use value on alcohol, and we don't want to rid ourselves of joy, right? Like we, you know, there's kind of the conversation about like, well, yeah, you could live a lot longer, you know, if you never ate red meat and if you never, you know, never smoked a cigar and, you know, you stayed out of the sun, et cetera, but at what cost, at what point does the forfeiture of pleasure outweigh the, you know, potential suffering that you may incur down the line? And, and I think like that is core to what you refer to in the book as a radical politics of alcohol, right? It's not just let's smash the interests that currently control this. How do we rebuild this in a way that, you know, gives us a shot at more joy, at more pleasure in the future? And, you know, towards the end of the book, you turn towards the your manifesto, your here are the things that we would do. And, or, you know, if we were to achieve this, many of them are based on regulating the industry.
Yeah.
But some of them are based on deregulating other industries and building other infrastructure. And I would love to talk about that a little bit because I think a lot of people perceive this type of argument on its face as a prohibitionist or prohibition adjacent argument. And I, having read the book, I don't think that's the argument that you're making. So I want to give you an opportunity to create a little daylight between what you're arguing for and what neo-prohibitionists who say no more alcohol, let's get rid of this.
No, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak on that because, like, I do think a lot of you know, well-meaning and really great like public health people will again like they will underestimate like the joy and the qualities that are found within alcohol. And so like the first half of this quote unquote manifesto does talk about, you know, degrowing big alcohol and like, you know, and a lot of these are taken from sort of WHO like recommendations, what they call like their best buys or whatever, which I don't love the language of, but it's, you know, it's about like reducing the density of like liquor. It's about like increasing pricing. It's about doing all these things that are like very contested, but ultimately are like very evidence-based ways of like reducing industry revenues and profits and also like, well, and reducing consumption and harms. But like you say, like I don't want to end it there because I think that's where a lot of public health people end it. And then they get confused why people like
why everyone fucking hates them.
Yeah, exactly. Cause like to reiterate, like the world like sucks, you know, like for, you know, most people and like it's, you know, the alienation and the exploitation and everything is just like just devastating, especially during this like pandemic. Right. So, so I think it's really necessary to come up with like alternatives, which is why I say like, you know, degrowing big alcohol and regrowing these like community owned and controlled alternatives. So these would include, you know, creating like non-alcoholic spaces, like public spaces. So like nice places to be. So like, you know, public parks, amenities, you know, like all age, you know, venues, like late night places for people to go where like alcohol is present, but it's not necessarily the only thing that you have to use or whatever. Right.
And that exists in other countries. You make a reference to many Western European nations have beer gardens and parks that you can get beer if you want to, but you can also just hang out in the park. That's an example of that. I wanted to mention that because like to the average American, sometimes it's hard to conceive of what you even mean when you're talking about non-privatized gathering spaces, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And like, honestly, I think like looking to a lot of like Muslim majority countries where like alcohol isn't like used extensively or whatever, is like, there's, you know, like there's hundreds of millions of people throughout the world who like do lots of like interesting and fun things that don't revolve around alcohol. So I think like thinking about that is worthwhile. I think, you know, creating like legitimate alternatives and like intoxicating alternatives to alcohol, I think is like really worthwhile as well. So for one, like we've seen this big surge in non-alcoholic like beverages, which I think is, which is great. And I think there's a lot of merits to that. And you know, I think that that should be publicly owned and scaled up. But at the same time, like I think it's like somewhat patronizing to think that, you know, you just like swap out an alcoholic for a non-alcoholic Heineken and someone's not going to like notice the difference. Like there's reasons people drink. And right. So I think, you know, for one, like there's really interesting R&D work going into like this thing called like synthetic alcohol by like, sure, David Nutt, which is, I won't get into, but I think like something like that is like somewhat promising in the sense that like, here's this guy who's like studied like all the detrimental impacts of alcohol, who like advocates for psychoactive substances and who argues that like, if you really want people to like not experience the harms of alcohol, you got to give them like something that like feels and tastes and like you feel, you know, you experience alcohol. Right. So that's something I think is like interesting. It's not something I'm gonna like bank on. I think that the better alternative in this case is like legalizing and regulating drugs, like criminalized drugs. Yep. So things like cannabis, a lot of, you know, psychedelics, like all these sorts of things that people already use, and that give like a lot of, you know, pleasure, and that we've already seen a lot of cases being made for substitution. You know, people who have like used alcohol in high risk ways, given the opportunity to use cannabis or use LSD or use mushrooms or whatever. I think there's a lot of merit in that as well. And I think once again, that really like confronts kind of head on the fact that that people want to experience like alternating their consciousness or experiencing pleasure in different ways. But I think the really important part, and this is kind of, this is how I begin and end the book, is that if we're going to do something, you know, if we're going to legalize and regulate other drugs, we have to learn from the experience of the alcohol industry, and we have to have this like publicly owned and controlled as an industry in order to maximize like the opportunities and the use values while minimizing the potential harms that come from it. And in saying that, I'm not saying that cannabis or LSD or mushrooms or whatever drug we're talking about is more harmful than alcohol, because I think alcohol is like, for a lot of reasons, uniquely, or you know, there are certain characteristics which are especially detrimental. But I do think that, like, in order, like we've seen it play out in Canada, where like the, you know, cannabis industry has, it was legalized and regulated, which is great, but it was done through like private producers and retailers, and we're already seeing some of the same concentration happen, where like a few, right, like a few companies are kind of consolidating power and having all sorts of impacts on workers and all the rest. So,
and those companies, I think, like, by the way, just interject real quick, are, yeah, also, guess where they're looking, is the alcohol industry to acquire producers here in the U.S., like Tilray being one of them, has, yeah, acquired Sweetwater, has acquired Alpine, yeah, and are looking to kind of get their feet in the game, not with cannabis beverage, cannabis and alcohol products, which is a big no-no and, mm-hmm, would incur a lot of federal wrath here in the U.S., mm-hmm, but to do, mm-hmm, the same things, to learn from the craft beer, yeah, producers in terms of marketing, in terms of distribution, to be able to do those same things. So we're talking again about accumulation. We're talking about, yeah, you know, marketing savvy. So they're doing the same things, in other words.
Yeah, totally. And then like, I'll just like wrap up by talking about like the need for actual structural, harm reduction in a way, which industry is definitely not, talking about, is like in the case of US, like universal healthcare and like people being able to access primary healthcare, which can connect, yes, them with resources, right, is like, is absolutely like an imperative. And I mean, you know, primary healthcare needs to be improved on this front too, in the sense that people need to have access to medication assisted treatment if they want it. They need access to non-abstinence based like peer support groups or like different sorts of resources like, yep, that, in which you don't have to like give up alcohol for life in order to like be able to, you know, talk about these sorts of things.
Sure.
But also just like from an infrastructural level, it's like, you know, the highest risks that, or the, you know, the highest rates of harm that occur are often associated with people who don't have housing, who are forced to drink and drive because there is like no good public transit in their area.
Yep.
Like all these sorts of things. Like if we want to address, say, drunk driving, which is like one of the biggest causes of alcohol related harms, provide like free and high quality transit. I mean, I'm kind of shouting out my previous book, but if you like get like that runs like throughout the night, that gives people an opportunity to like hop on a train or a bus and get home safely. These are like structural things that actually will improve safety for people. And then finally is like understanding this within the global context and really committing to global solidarity and reparations for like colonized and oppressed countries throughout the world, is that like for a lot of like very poor countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, alcohol is like one of the few industries and one of the few tax bases that they can rely on. And so that this can create all sorts of like very intense structural harms in which a government is essentially dependent on like the alcohol industry.
Right.
And so this is like, I mean, that might seem like kind of like a far out like or unrelated point to this, but I think it is important because as drinking rates begin to stagnate, especially among like younger people in North America or Europe, against the wishes of the industry, there is a lot of migration of industry to other countries. And I mentioned like Vietnam and Mexico already, but like this is going to continue to escalate in the years to come.
All right. That was the Fingers Podcast with James Wilt, part 2. Hopefully you found it as fascinating as I did. Please pick up a copy of Drinking Up the Revolution at the Fingers Reading Room or wherever else you buy your books or the local library if they've got it. Hopefully they do. To keep up with James, you can also follow him on Twitter at James_M_Wilt. Part 1 of this interview is already available for Friends of Fingers, and you should definitely go check that out if you enjoyed this part, which is part 2 of 2. You can listen to the episodes out of order. It doesn't really matter. It's just him and I talking through the themes of the book. So whatever you're into. Big thanks to James for coming on the Fingers Podcast, and big thanks to you, yes you, for supporting the Booze Letter with your paid subscription. Only paying Friends of Fingers have access to this and every interview that we've ever done here on the Fingers Podcast. So make sure you share it on social media so everyone else realizes they're missing out and decides to pony up. Signing off from Fingers HQ, it's your fearless Fingers editor, Dave Infante, reminding you that better things are possible and maybe a better approach to alcohol, too. Bye-bye.